Hi, I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Ada Calhoun is a freelance writer and author based in New York City. When she wrote an article for the New York Times this summer called "The Wedding Toast I'll Never Give," it was insightful and charming and just very real, and I had to have her on the show. You wrote for the New York Times, is where I first read you in article form, and I was really curious to see why you decided to write "The Wedding Toast I'll Never Give," and like, what, obviously you had this. You know, marital experience of your flight. For people who don't know about your article or haven't read it, maybe you could kind of give us a little background.
Sure. Well, my husband and I were married when we were in our late 20s. And in New York City, that's considered early. I mean, it's basically, you know, we might as well have gotten married in high school because all of our friends were single then. Most of them still are. And then some of them now are getting married in their mid to late 30s. So we're going to these weddings and we're this old married couple, even though we're 39. And so we've been sitting there after 10 years of marriage at these weddings, which have been beautiful affairs with people we love. But we find ourselves sort of elbowing each other when it comes time for the vows that people have written. And the vows often are things like, "I will never let you down ever. I will be your best friend every second of the day." And after 10 years of marriage, you have a little bit more realism about what's going to happen.
Yeah, and so in the article, you talked about this situation with your plane tickets, and I loved the part that was just, that was great. That it winds up at the end. It's this like kind of surprise ending, and the really cool part that I think a lot of people latched onto, which I appreciated as well, was that this "and yet" part. It was this kind of realistic, but perseverant look at staying married, being married, and staying married. And so, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, so the frame of the story, I mean, it's basically this. There's something going through my head at weddings of couples who are just now entering the institution, and it was framed around this fight my husband and I had about this travel. Basically, we had this plan to all go together to Minneapolis because I had to be in a conference, and we thought, "Oh, it'll be great. He can do a show. He's a musician, and our son can play in the pool. It'll be so fun." And then, of course, as these things do sometimes, they got very complicated because of his schedule, and he got a different gig, and it got messier and messier, and involved all this, basically involved a lot of money and a lot of logistics. And it was so frustrating, and it was so sort of typical of a fight you have after being married for 10 years, where it's like nobody is really at fault, but you're just so irritated. And so the refrain that I had in the story was this sense of "and yet," which I feel like is something that's echoed through the marriages of almost every couple I know who've been together a really long time, which is, you know, you have this love, and yet you want to kill the person, and then you want to kill the person, and yet you love them. And it's this cycle that sort of keeps spinning as long as you stay married. And, you know, the quote from my mother in the story is, "The way you stay married is you don't get divorced."
Right. It's like, yeah, that is true. and it's funny too, what the line you said was, how was it? It was like, if we stay married, we're just as married as the person who had it perfect.
Right.
You know, and it was
assuming,
like,
there is such a person out there.
Right. Yes.
As if
they're just a liar if they say they are. So one of the reasons I loved my husband and I just celebrated 20 years of marriage. And
congratulations.
In a way, much to my surprise, because I was, from the very beginning, I would have told anyone, "We're getting married and I don't know how to do this." You know, like my parents had divorced, and I felt like if you bring in a toolbox for your marriage as you go into it based on your you know, previous boyfriends or what you saw your mom and dad do or what you saw your relatives do and mm-hmm. some of the other influences. If you bring a toolbox in, I had like a tweezer in there and a bent screwdriver and that's it. There were tools in there at all. And I thought, I don't know if this is going to work. And I think just because I didn't know how to fix stuff, if it goes bad, you know, and I remember thinking every fight would be like, that's it. I guess this is it. We're going to break up, you know, and this went on for a couple of years where I would think doom is there for sure. And I wound up having a few friends whose parents, both sets of their parents had stayed married. So it was like two couples represented by eight, I guess that would be four marriages held together still. And I said, well, don't you ever feel this feeling like you're like on a precipice? And they're like, no. I said, well, I was like, what? Okay. It's obviously just me. And I said, you don't feel like, you know, well, how do you know that it'll work? And they're like, well, you just keep doing it. You just keep staying married.
Right.
And I was like, that hit me like a bolt of lightning. It shouldn't have, but you know, are your parents together?
They are still together. They've been married for, I think, 41 years now.
Yeah. And so that's your mother's advice was like advice that she took herself.
Yes, she did. And I think people didn't, they're an odd couple, my parents. And I think some people didn't give them the best odds in the world. And I think it was at various points, it was a sheer force of will.
Yeah.
And now they're happy.
Right.
They're glad.
Yeah. But it's interesting too, is we treat marriage a little bit, maybe even a little bit different than we treat other relationships. Cause I'm thinking of like my kids, they're not going to just not be my kids. You know, that's a relationship. Obviously it's a flesh and blood relationship, mm-hmm. but I'm also thinking like if we thought of marriage the same way as mm-hmm. other flesh and blood relationships, like even if you did get divorced, in a way you're still married to the person because mm-hmm. you shared life together and there's still this connection that you could never, unless you had a amnesia or brain injury and forgot about them, like you really they wouldn't ever really go away. And I think we tend to have, or at least there's a little bit of social pressure to have these caveats, like, well, if it doesn't work out, I can still get out of it, which of course you can, but if you go in thinking I'll probably be able to get out of this if I want to, mm-hmm. you know, it winds up setting up a whole different string of thought process and everything.
Yeah. No, I think it is true that it's more like kids than boyfriends in mm-hmm. a way. Like it's, you know, it's family. Mm-hmm. And I actually, one of the comments, I got so many nice comments on the Times site, and then I got just emails all weekend from people, especially couples that had been married for like 40 and 50 years. And it was really sweet to read all these stories about all these horrible things everybody had been through and survived, and how happy they were that they had. Mm-hmm. And one of them was saying something about having made the transition from thinking of marriage as dating to thinking of it as being family, and you can't really get rid of family, you know, even if you want to.
And even if you could, the person, especially if you've had kids with them, right. you know, when my parents divorced, they had to stay in contact because mm-hmm. there we were, you know. And right. so I remember thinking, well, they're still fighting. They're just in two houses.
Right. which can be better, you know.
Right, it can be. Yeah. And sometimes, and that's not to say that there aren't instances where people should get divorced if there's, right. you know, obviously I'm not like thinking if there's some major abuse or some major right, issue going on, of course we have to consider safety and things like that first, but I also feel like when somebody is actually not being cynical about marriage, that it's so refreshing. It's like realistic, but you know, not Pollyanna, but a kind of like, yeah, you know what, it's gonna kind of really suck sometimes,
right?
And then you know, after a while, you'll be glad you stuck it out too, because there'll be joy. You know, there's going to be joy and pain both. And it's interesting to approach that with someone newlywed that, you know, you don't know what you're like. I know why people cry at weddings now. It's because you realize that it's kind of the most beautiful and painful thing you can sign up for voluntarily. You know,
right? It's true. Mm-hmm. No, and those things, I think, I think it's good to remember that it's that those things are so intertwined in every moment that mm-hmm. even when it's really awful, it can be very wonderful at the same time, and vice versa.
Yeah. And so I know you're in New York mm-hmm. City, and we'll talk about your book in a little bit, but I wanted to if we could talk a little bit about the book you wrote on parenting and what got you to write that, and some of the background and the outcomes that happened with that book. I'm pretty curious about that too.
Oh, sure. It feels like a really long time ago. it was a long time ago, but I was working at an online magazine, and I was running it, and it was a parenting site, and I was being inundated with advice about pacifiers and baby seats and all these things, and I had a new baby at home, mm-hmm. And I was wanting to write a different book. I wanted to write a book about crushes, and I wound up going out to dinner with these editors who had no interest in that book, but they said, you know, you're around all this baby stuff, and why don't you write about babies? And I said, well, I mean, all I could think of is I don't want there to be any more books. I'm really tired of all the advice. And if I was going to write a book, it would be about how you should ignore all the books. And they're like, well, write that as a book.
Yeah.
And so that's what it wound up being, was basically the idea of it was as an antidote to this barrage of information and expertise that I found exhausting and distracting and not very helpful.
Yeah, it's true. We have so much access to so much information and no way to process all of it. And it winds up, I think, just leaving us in angst. And I'm probably doing something wrong because I haven't, you know, assimilated all this wisdom and all the books and everything.
Right. So the book is called Instinctive Parenting because it was about that sense that maybe it's most helpful to, you know, look at your kid and figure out who they are and have a relationship as opposed to trying to like ace it, you know?
Yeah, right. And also every kid is so unique that the thing that'll work like great on the one kid might not work on the next kid. And,
exactly. Yeah.
Do you just have one son or do you have more?
I have a son who's, he's almost 9. And then I have a stepson who is 21.
Oh, okay. So that, yeah, you don't have to worry about that. The mothering is probably over in that category. Yeah. But, oh, that's really neat. And so, so tell me a little bit about, like, growing up in the East Village, right? Is that it?
I did grow up in the East Village, yes, St. Mark's Place. And so I have this book about the history of St. Mark's Place, going back before it was even a street, so going back 400 years. And it seemed really normal when I was growing up. And then much later, I learned that actually it was pretty insane. I was one of the only kids in the neighborhood. There weren't that many of us. And it was sort of right after the economy in New York City had tanked. And so a lot of people had left for the suburbs. And my parents, being really good bohemians, had stuck it out in their walk-up apartment. That's where I grew up. It was, you know, it was not the most, I guess, child-friendly moment in New York City's history, because there were a lot of, you know, fires because people were burning their buildings down with insurance money, and there were a lot of drugs, and homelessness was really big at the time, and you know, as I was growing up, AIDS hit really hard right in our area, so it was, you know, it seemed normal, and I had a really nice childhood, but it was a little bleak, probably, in retrospect.
And how did your parents end up there in the first place?
My father was a poet, and then he was writing for the Village Voice, and my mother was an actress, and so they had both gravitated to New York City to be part of the art world and the performing world in the 60s.
Yeah, so, oh, okay, so that was a really, that's like... you know, Simon and Garfunkel, maybe I'm getting the time period wrong. Maybe that's a little later.
They were more like Dylan, you know,
okay.
Greenwich Village, coffee shoppy period when they arrived.
Yeah, and that's definitely a hub of like artistic culture and the hippies and.
Yes.
Yeah, that's so. That must have been an interesting childhood. Did your parents have a lot of friends that were doing drugs and stuff, or did it just...
They were pretty well behaved, I think, by the time I came along. So it wasn't really so much debauchery. It was, I mean, they knew a lot of artists and mm-hmm. a lot of creative people. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up in the art world, sort of surrounded by a lot of grown-ups, mostly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the baby bust, pretty much.
Exactly. We were right dead in the middle of the baby bust. And it's funny because, and also I think because the neighborhood was pretty rough then, I didn't go out and play outside by myself, for example. So, and we couldn't, the park nearest my house growing up was full of Tent City. It was all junkies and there was prostitution. And so we weren't really allowed to go in that park. And we went to a park kind of further away where you'd occasionally see another child and wave at them, hopefully. But I've just now met some people who grew up in my neighborhood at the same time I did. Just in the course of recording this book, I met these two girls. Oh. And it's so funny because we had almost identical experiences growing up in a lot of ways. They grew up like five buildings down from me or something crazy like that. They're wonderful. I like them a lot. We're friendly now. But I had never met them until this year. And we're like in our
place. That's so funny. Well, yeah. Then what about school then? How far away was school for you?
I went to school, to elementary school in the West Village, to a school called PS 41. Mm-hmm. I think the statute of limitations has run out now, so my parents won't be, you know, killed for having put our name on my best friend's mailbox.
Oh, okay. I was thinking, like, why didn't you have kids from school nearby? Yeah. But that was probably a better school, and so they...
It was a really good school.
Yeah. Oh, and so do you think that being inside a lot kind of positioned you to be a writer? Do you think that had an influence on you?
Oh, maybe. I mean, and also just the sort of the boredom. I think if you don't have a lot else to do, then I think writing is, you know, it can pass the time.
Yeah. And then did you decide you wanted to do that from an early age, or did you kind of happen into writing?
I think I always wanted to do it. Like, I definitely edited the junior high school paper and the this high school magazine and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I always read a lot. It seemed like a natural extension of just reading constantly.
Ah, and I don't know where you went to college, but did you wind up staying in the city or did you go elsewhere?
I went to McGill in Montreal for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And I was doing like religious studies and Sanskrit, and then I dropped out and worked on a farm, and then I wound up finishing my degree at UT Austin.
Oh, okay. And that's probably where I saw I was reading some of your stuff from that area of the country, and I was like, is this the same person?
That's funny. Yeah, so I wound up I really thought I was going to be like a Sanskrit professor, and I was at UT Austin and having a really good time, but then I was trying to make some money while I was in school, and I started working at the Austin Chronicle as an intern and then just doing whatever they wanted done. So I wound up writing about all kind of random things. Like, I'd get sent to like a boxing match or to a reading or to a play or whatever it was nobody else wanted to do any given week. So I wound up just writing a ton for them, and I liked that so much that I couldn't do that and be a Sanskrit professor. It quickly, became apparent to me. So I just wound up kind of fully going into journalism.
Yeah, and you could cut your teeth on all those different types of like, you know, random, what seems like random articles, but then that's kind of how you can get your chops, is by doing some of those things.
No, it was really nice to just be able to do, I mean, that's the thing I still love about being a journalist, is being able to have a different day every day. I mean, I was just in the Bronx, in family court reporting a story, and then 2 days later, I'll be at some crazy show, or, you know, just every day is different, and I really appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely. The variety is really nice. And so, you still live in the same area that you grew up in, right?
I'm not far away. I'm like a subway stop away in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. So I can get to my folks' place in about 15 minutes, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, maybe we could talk a little bit, we could transition and talk a little bit about your book and why you would write it. I did read a little bit about the idea that people continually say that that area is dead or it's no good or anymore. that's the typical refrain.
Yes.
Because I guess, you know, if you're... if you're a trendy or hip place, then that'll have a shelf life, and then it'll kind of, but it'll turn into something else probably.
Well, it's funny because I've heard from people in a lot of other cities that that's something that happens mm-hmm. there too. There's just this sense that once you get to a certain age, especially that the town that you fell in love with isn't the same place, and it's very natural to at that point say, well, it's dead, it's over. And it's very tragic in a way, because I think people talk about it as if they've been broken up with, that this place has abandoned them and changed in this way that is like a betrayal. So I was looking at that just recently, because it was a lot of people who had been here in the 70s or 80s. And then now, because it's much more corporate in the East Village, there are banks and Starbucks and things like that. And rent is so high that they felt that sense of just like they've been left, and they're really upset about it. And so I was looking at it historically and seeing that that's something that's happened to pretty much every generation for the last century, where I had somebody who had been actually house sitting for the poet W.H. Auden in the 50s, and he'd been there and having a really good time, but people kept saying to him, you know, it's really dead now. You missed it. In the 30s, it was so exciting, and you're just really too late. It's too bad. And then he left New York and came back in the 60s, and people were saying to him, you know what, it's pretty good now, but you missed it. The really best part was in the 50s. 50s was, and he was like, but I was here in the 50s.
That's so funny.
Yeah, there's this quote from, I think it's Malcolm Cowley, that's that goes, Bohemia is always yesterday.
Oh, that's, yeah, I've never thought of that. Huh. And so what kind of groups hang out now in that area?
So on St. Mark's Place now, there's been this boom in Japanese and Korean restaurants and karaoke places. And I went out, actually I took a few of the people I'd met who grew up in the neighborhood, just who I've met in the last year, and I was like, let's all go out. We'll go out on the town and stay out really late. And we did. We went and, you know, had many drinks, and we did karaoke. And I have to say, it's really fun. These places are great. They're pretty cheap. And they're packed with all of these teenagers and 20-somethings who are just having the time of their life. So that hasn't changed at all.
Yeah, but I bet nobody would have thought in the 70s, or maybe even when you were growing up there, that one day we'll get to do karaoke here.
It's true. Well, I think it is really funny that that a lot of the karaoke songs you can do are songs that came from the place. So Blondie used to walk around there, you know, the Ramones, Television, like all these different bands that started, New York Dolls, like that all started on or around St. Mark's Place, and at CBGB, which is not very far away. They now are represented in t-shirts and fashion things and karaoke songs.
Yeah, retro. Yeah, but that's funny. And so I had never even been to New York City until, I'm from Pittsburgh area, and I went to Kutztown University, which there's like a Bieber bus that goes to Midtown 9 times a day. So you can get to New York City pretty easily. And so we would go there, and being an art major, you definitely had to do that, you know, and we'd go to Soho and galleries and things like that. And when I was there, my first time to New York City, I was like, people were like, wear black, don't look at anyone in the eye. And I was like terrified, even though it wasn't that big of a deal. But there was a lot of, this was before Rudy Giuliani was there, and there was a big homeless problem around. And then I guess when I came back again, it was like there had been a renaissance where Times Square was not all these like girly XXX shops and stuff. Like it had been really transformed, and there were strollers in Times Square. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is really, you know, then Broadway had a big boom, and things change really fast. And you never really know if a neighborhood is just about to get gentrified, or is just about to go down the drain, or what. But I know it seems like there's there's complaining. people will say, no matter how the neighborhood's changing, there will be complaints.
And that's the one constant,
Yeah, it's really funny because a friend of ours was living in Hell's Kitchen. Just as that started kind of getting gentrified, a lot of restaurants in there. And then people move out for that reason, of course, and as other people are moving in. And so, yeah, it's interesting. So during the time that your parents have been there, how many times do you think it's sort of changed over to sort of a new cultural manifestation, or however you would put it?
I think there have been a few waves. I think there was, they were there around in the sort of hippie boom or late hippie boom, and then they were around for the punk era. Mm-hmm. And then I was born sort of right around then, and then there was the sort of DIY East Village art scene of the 80s. And then I think a lot of people say that when the Gap moved in to the corner of St. Mark's and 2nd Avenue, they feel like that was when there was a big turn. So I was 88, I think. And then and then there was the era of Kids, the movie, and all the skaters, which I was a teenager for. And then sort of Bloomberg era with just this huge boom in construction. So it's been a few different cycles.
Yeah, I think the I'm trying to think. I haven't. Well, where do you say is in Manhattan anyway? Where would you say is kind of the artsy cultural hotspot now?
Bushwick. It's definitely, huge. Like, if you go out there, it's amazing. There's like galleries all over the place. There's young people making stuff on like every corner. It's still relatively cheap. I mean, it's expensive for anywhere else in the world, but for New York City, there are kids who are able to spend a few hundred dollars a month to share a place. It's enormous, and yeah, it's like a few stops away from the East Village, but I don't think that means that New York City is dead just because you have to get on the L train for 10 minutes, It's like, there are definitely still a lot of young people here doing a lot of very exciting things.
Yeah, I think there's a stigma of once a franchise moves in, the whole place is sold out. Now it can't be redeemed. It's,
right.
And I was really practically startled because it was this period of time when we go into New York City mainly for touristy things like seeing a show or some museum or something, and there was a point where you'd go. And it was one way. And then there was a point where it came back and there was a Starbucks on every corner. It was like something had turned over. And I'm like, well, apparently Starbucks has made it to New York City. And I guess this is how you get coffee now. I was just kind of surprised in a way because sometimes the city obviously there's lots of chains and franchises and stuff. Mm-hmm. But there's also a lot of kind of one-off places, and especially like I would go to New York City for a day just for the food because you can get any kind of food and it's authentic, whether you want I want Southern Vietnamese, with my frog legs done a certain way or something. Mm-hmm. And that for sure you can get it. And that's what I've loved about New York City. And maybe other people feel this way too, is that once you get sort of like the bland franchise that would be in Boise also is in New York City, which seems, exciting and cool and a melting pot. And then if it gets too many franchises in, then you're like, oh, well, this isn't any different than any other, other place.
Yeah. And that's the fear. And when places you've loved for a long time close and the new places open, it's scary. I will say that on St. Mark's Place, like the Gap eventually closed. And then in the last few years, there was a 7-Eleven that opened and closed and a Pinkberry that opened and closed. So on St. Mark's Place, it's been pretty hard for franchises to stick around. I'm not sure why, but they haven't lasted. And there's places that have been there since the 60s. Like I take my son to get his hair cut at this place called Royal Barber, and they've been there. The chairs are from, I think we looked on the bottom last time I was there, from 1960. So the chairs alone, but they've, that place has been there doing the same thing, like cutting men's hair for, you know, at least 60 years.
Yeah, and I think when you visit a neighborhood and you know that it has certain unique things that you can't find elsewhere, then you continue to go for those things if you're not from that neighborhood. But then if, you know, it's true that some of the shine wears off if it's just like, oh, well, that's a Chick-fil-A. And I'm wondering, too, I know some people look for chains because even though, like, the food is going to be mediocre, they at least know what they're getting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course.
And they won't feel like they've wasted their money or something like
right.
that.
Right, and it's
like,
cheap. And, yeah.
Yeah, but I'm a little, I'm much more on the other side of, I know if I'm going to go to Little Italy, I know, you know, we're going to get something nice and authentic. And, you know, if I wind up not liking it or getting food poisoning or something, that that's fine. You know, that doesn't really happen, but it's like part of the adventure for me. And I guess it just depends on why you're coming to the particular neighborhood, if you're up for that or not.
And luckily, people tend to go to the East Village for, you know, for more eccentric things. And so they'll go to Little India on 6th Street, and, you know, for Indian food, they're not going to be looking for a Chipotle there. So it works out.
And so what are some places, you know, since you're from the area, what are some places you would recommend visiting for someone who wants to check out that area? And what do you... if we know if they want a haircut, they can go to the Royal Barber.
Royal's really good. They're really nice. And so I guess I really believe in, like, just walking the length of St. Mark's Place. So it starts at 3rd Avenue and goes to Avenue A. So it's only 3 blocks. Mm-hmm. And you end up in Tompkins Square Park, which is beautiful now. I mean, it really has been fixed up. And it's there's a great playground. There's great just paths. And it's very leafy. And then I would say there's still a lot of great bars. Grassroots Tavern has been there forever. You get like $1 popcorn and really cheap beer. It's always kind of cool. It's a little bit subterranean. And then there are a lot of great restaurants. Like, I love Cafe Mogador and Cafe Orlin. La Palapa is this incredible Mexican place that's been there since I was a kid. And then shopping. There's still like thrift stores around. I love Angela's Vintage is my favorite, like, vintage clothing store that's on 2nd Avenue. So there's just a lot of shopping. I mean, and also it's just fun to, like, look at all the punk kids. I mean, there's still a lot of, like, punk teenagers who come there to get piercings and to sit outside with each other and drink beer out of paper bags. And they're very adorable.
Yeah. So do you think that what do you think the next shift will be after the whole karaoke thing? You have any ideas what could happen next?
I don't know. I think this will be for a while, as these, because it's, you know, it's the teenagers are really, really into it, and they don't seem like they're gonna let up anytime soon. So but I don't know. I think it's crazy to think that the rents will keep going up forever, because that's, I mean, just if you look at the historical patterns, they go up really high and then they go down and then they go back up. So, you know, a lot of people say this is different. It's like hyper gentrification and it's just going to keep skyrocketing. But I mean, I would be surprised if that were the case.
Yeah. I know with a friend of mine was working in Brooklyn at the Teen Challenge Drug Rehab Center, worked there for years, and it had been a total bargain to get something in Brooklyn, and also you could easily get murdered there. It was like there was a couple kidnappings and a couple of little crazy things, and now, like, you can't get property that's worth more probably than that area of Brooklyn that's all gotten built up. And that was like that was another 20-year thing where it got it just, the prices just skyrocketed, and it is really fascinating. I don't know if, I'm sure other major cities have that same kind of thing, but being from where I live out here in the boondocks, you know, there is something very different that happens in New York City with trends in real estate and all that stuff of different neighborhoods changing over that doesn't seem to happen quite the same way, except for maybe with the exception of a few other major cities.
Mm-hmm. No, it's amazing. I think the median apartment now is more than $1 million to buy.
Really? Where would that, in Manhattan?
Is it Manhattan or New York City? I can't remember.
Like all five boroughs?
Yeah, maybe it's Manhattan. But yeah, it's insane. It's just ridiculously expensive, and we're all crazy. But where else are we going to live? We can't live anywhere else.
I know, right? Can you imagine living in a different spot?
No, I can't at all. It's really, I'm doomed. There's no, I grew up here and I can't really envision it. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we have some friends that live in Central Park North, like right near Harlem, mm-hmm. kind of in an area of Harlem that's just starting to change, big surprise. And I think like 4 or 5 blocks down is Neil Patrick Harris's place, and he bought uh-huh. like a whole building or something.
Yeah.
And so that's set to light up probably around there. And I think that when it's really beautiful right near Central Park, mm-hmm. and I hadn't seen much of that side of the city, but that's another place that is really a bargain right now to get. I think it's like $350 for an apartment or something. But
I think it used to be. I think even.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Just in the last while, it's like because of Neil Patrick Harris and some other celebrities have moved up there. It is beautiful, but yeah, it's still
it's really gone expensive. Up. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then I guess you can make your fortune that way too if you pick the right spots.
Right.
But yeah, that's really neat. And so then you have your son. Does your son go to public school?
He does go to public school, yeah, near mm-hmm. us in Brooklyn.
Yeah, I know that's one of the things that people from, like, not in the city always think, well, you're going to send your kid to public school? Is that going to be, like, this big deal? But I think I'm sure it just varies on whatever neighborhood you're in. And
it's a lot better than when I was a kid.
Oh, yeah. And yeah, I guess really, so, right.
It's so funny because I think a lot of the parents that, meet in the city who didn't grow up in the city will mm-hmm. be shocked by certain things about New York City public schools. And mm-hmm. I just, the contrast between what it was like when I was a kid, I mean, like now they have like all these things that I just don't at all take for granted. Like they have music classes and they have art and they go outside every day. I don't know. There's all these things that they do. And I'm like, oh, look how nice it is. And of course, meanwhile, the parents who grew up with like football fields are like, what are you talking about? It's terrible. So anyway, I guess it's good to like lower your expectations dramatically because everything then is really a lovely surprise.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, you're right. You can only go up from there, I guess.
Yeah.
Art class. But I'm sure there's and there's also just probably more kids to make sure that, there's more parents involved because there's more kids around in those different areas so that that changes.
It's way nicer. I mean, it mm-hmm. just is like, just as for a kid, mm-hmm. it's objectively way better. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just, he can go to the playground, he can go to the park, and it feels like things are built for him in a way that things were not built for us when we were kids.
Yeah, yeah, I see what you mean. That's great. Well, so where's the best place people can reach you if they want to find out about your book and some of your articles and what you're up to? Where would you like them to go?
They can just go to adacalhoun.com, so adacalhoun, and the book is called St. Mark's is Dead, so stmarksisdead.com too.
That's very good, and that'll be out in early November.
Yeah, right? November 2nd from North.
November 2nd, very good. And I will definitely have show notes that will include links and things like that to make it simple for people to get to the different spots to read what you have and hopefully get kind of introduced to an area of New York that if they're interested in or even fearful of, the fear will go away. Or if they're interested in the scene, that they can kind of, that's neat that you have a whole history there because it's a vibrant history. And I guess in the beginning, before it was even a street, like what was happening in New York City 400 years ago anyway?
Well, it was, so there were Lenape Indians and then the Dutch showed up. And the area around St. Mark's Place was Peter Stuyvesant, the first director general, his farm. So it was, people say St. Mark's Place may have been his pear orchard. He was a big fan of pears. But before he was there, it was a hunting grounds and it was full of rabbits and deer and wild turkey and blue jays and salamanders and all these things. So, wasn't that long ago that it was a forest.
It sounds impossible to believe.
I know. It is hard to believe when you walk around.
And it's called St. Mark's Place because of a church there?
Yes.
Or?
It was named after St. Mark's Church, which is a couple of blocks north. And it's where my parents were married. And it is the oldest site of continuous worship in New York City.
Oh, wow. Do you go to church there?
I have been. I've been to funerals there and things like that.
Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I'm as far as, like, how many people would you say go to St. Mark's Place on a Sunday?
It's gotten a lot bigger. There's a story in my book about this kind of break that happened in 1969, where the old rector was, the hippie priest, this guy named Michael Allen, was forced out by a group that called itself the Black and Brown Caucus. And it was a time of, you know, real racial tension, and they had a real showdown, and he basically handed the church over to them. He was also a civil rights leader. And so at that moment, the parishioners, a lot of parishioners left. So they've been building up more or less since then.
Mm-hmm.
And now, just in the last couple of years, it's boomed again, I think. So last I heard, it was back up to about 200 people, which is where it was, you know, in 69 before the break.
Oh, and is it racially diverse?
It really is now. Yeah, and they do, it's like a liberation-based theology, and they're very in tune with social justice movements, and the group that took over the church, they opened one of the first prison libraries with the Black Panthers, and it has this history of being very progressive.
Wow. Well, that's neat. That'd be another thing I would have to add to my agenda, I think.
It's worth going. And, you know, this service is really, it's really unique and moving. They implemented all these changes in the late 60s. So they, for example, don't they don't have the Eucharist from the priest. They pass it person to person, and they sing hymns in Spanish, and they do a lot of things that they implemented back then that have worked out really well for the church.
I really hope you enjoyed the show today. Please come by sparkmymuse.com for related show notes and links and all kinds of other information. Don't forget to subscribe, and please give us 5 stars on iTunes.